Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It just snowed for the first time this week in D.C.,
Is
so
that right?
not looking forward to going back out into the wilderness.
Now, you are not a northerner by birth, correct?
No, I'm from Florida, so next week I get to head back to the Sunshine State to see some family, and I'm very much so looking forward to that.
Well, how much snow did DC get? Enough to have the requisite blood feuds in the supermarket aisles over canned goods?
It was really dead outside when I walked into work this in the morning, and it was not. I mean, everybody panics here when it's 1.5 inches. I think they closed Fairfax County schools and things like that. So I don't know if there was panic in the grocery store aisles, though I will find out after I leave here today. I'll check on that for you.
Well, while we're taping on Thursday afternoon as we speak, the exact state of the tax cut deal is a little up in the air because with this one last gasp from the House Progressive Caucus and then some, I imagine, on the rule, which basically means how they're going to structure the debate on the House floor. And folks want to make sure they have the opportunity to register a no vote on the entirety of the bill and not be sort of railroaded into endorsing it in part. The expectation is they'll hammer it out by the time this airs. We don't know. With that in mind, there still is plenty of blogosphere commentary on the left and the right about this. I think over the past few days, the complaints on the right have ratcheted up, whereas on the initial announcement, it was the folks on the left that were making the biggest noise, but consternation on the right seems to have amplified.
Yes, although a lot of the sort of anger on the right is coming from outside of Congress. I mean, you've got folks like a Jim DeMint, who is, who has raised a lot of concern about this. But you've also got within Congress, you've got normally folks who are normally considered conservative favorites, folks like Paul Ryan, who is now coming out and he said that, he thinks that these people who are presidential aspirants, basically referring to Mitt Romney in his column from USA Today earlier this week. The folks who are on the line and have to vote on this, by and large, are not being as vocal in their criticism, whereas you've got someone like a Mitt Romney or a Sarah Palin, and they're coming out pretty opposed to, strongly opposed to the current deal and think that people should vote no on it, wait until conservatives can get a better deal come January when the new guard comes to town. And Daniel Foster at National Review had this interesting sort of write-up on what went down on Thursday afternoon. Said, "Here's what happens. Recall that the Democrats are moving the tax compromise inside of the hollowed-out shell of the Senate aviation bill in order to deny Republicans the procedural opportunity to offer their own alternative. Yes, it's as ridiculous as it sounds. Speaker Designate memorably dubbed the strategy 'chicken crap.' But for now, the Democrats are being hoisted by their own petard. In order to proceed as they'd liked, Democrats planned on holding a single vote on both the Pomeroy Amendment, which would raise the estate tax from the compromise level, and on the overall Senate bill, which meant that a vote for the Pomeroy estate tax hike was still a vote agreeing to the Senate bill in toto, but rank-and-file liberals wanted separate votes so they could support the estate tax hike while going on the record against the Obama-McConnell compromise." So while I'm not as aware of what's going on on the left and with regards to the Progressive Caucus, it sounds like by pushing it to the last minute, they're now really having to jump through some crazy procedural loops to attempt to make this work, and that Republicans, those who are opposed to this deal, are sort of sitting back and thinking like, okay, it's nice that this will be Democrats that are the ones to torpedo this and raise taxes on January 1st. So, what are you reading?
Well, just my own personal commentary there. I mean, I do. Part of the argument on the left to kill a deal was let's let the tax rates go up and blame the Republicans for it, because they held the middle class tax cuts hostage to tax cuts for the wealthy. I can't see how that logic follows when, as a Democrat, you are the ones who are actively killing the deal at the end of the day. Whatever logic the initial theory had. It wouldn't work in this scenario.
Well, and I guess President Obama's been calling members personally and telling them, if you don't pass this, this is the end of my presidency. And James Antelet at American Spectator, he wrote that Representative Peter DeFazio, who opposed the tax deal from the left, says President Obama's been telling congressional Democrats it's the end of his presidency if it doesn't pass. Well, that could increase Republicans' no votes, couldn't it?
That may have been DeFazio's incentive to utter that. You know, DeFazio said this on CNN secondhand. Mm-hmm. He did not get that message from the president directly, so we don't really know what exactly the president said. And I think DeFazio, as someone who's been one of the leading people trying to kill the deal, had great incentive to try to get more Republican no votes in the House by saying something like that. So I take that with a bit of a grain of salt. But to get back to liberal blogging on this, you know, obviously there was I think most liberal bloggers were opposed to this deal. I was not one of them, but I think a fair reading would be that the progressive bloggers was largely opposed. Arguably, the almost the seamlessness of argumentation between the liberal blogosphere and those in the House Progressive Caucus and elsewhere that were opposed to it is probably one of the first examples of the blogosphere and some Washington Democrats having a very seamless relationship. You haven't seen that messaging really flow on the left in that way, the way you do, I think, with some conservative blogging, conservative talk radio to Republican congresspeople. But in that initial enthusiasm, it's now being snuffed out because the Senate vote was so overwhelming. David Diane, who blogs at Fire Dog Lake, pointed out, you've no doubt seen all the whinging from liberal Democrats calling this the hardest vote they've had to take. Okay. By the way, I just want to make this clear. Jim DeMint opposed this bill. He voted against cloture for it as well. But when he chose a bill to needlessly delay and obstruct, he picked the START Treaty and the omnibus. Those are the ones on which he forced a full reading on the Senate floor, not the tax cut bill. In case you were wondering the difference between being against something and actually being against something. So there is this additional layer of... I mean, fury might be too strong, because I haven't seen enough blogging about this to warrant that. But agitation or consternation or what have you, that even those Democrats who are saying negative things about it are not really going to the mat. Al Franken put up a blog post at the Huffington Post. I think it was also an email to his supporters, also giving that line, the hardest vote I've had to take. And even took a shot at Obama, saying, why is he punting on first down? But one of the bloggers at America Blog goes by Gaius Publius, excuse my poor Latin, said, because Franken did vote for this. And so the headline is, Al Franken supports the Obama tax cut deal. Shades of the Iraq war vote when Dem after Senate Dem talked against and voted for. Deeds, folks, you're about to pull the bolt on the last lock on the door. The very time we live in calls you out. So there's a frustration. There was this initial hope in the blogosphere left that they were, I think, getting somewhere by having Democrats fight harder for progressive positions, and then not seeing the kind of follow through you get on the right is adding an extra layer of dismay.
Mm-hmm. With on the right, you're seeing some ire directed at very specific members. For instance, Senator John Thune brought up a little more public pushback against, you know, without saying the name Mitt Romney, pushback against Governor Romney's op-ed. And you have on Red State, Eric Erickson writing, quote, I get that John Thune loves his ethanol subsidies that raise the cost of food. I get that Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan always think the world is about to end without congressional action. But let's not buy into their notion that it's politically expedient to be among the few who are out there willing to stand up to their party and most of the political establishment and say that a deal stinks and ought to be killed. And then over at Hot Air, Olipundit also sort of takes a jab at Paul Ryan, which I just find incredibly curious, since he's usually just such a darling of the right. And it says, as expected, GOP supporters of the tax cut deal are going to use their opposition to the are going to use their opposition to the spending bill as cover for with the base for voting for this, the tax cut bill. Exit question. Ryan voted for TARP, the tax and the AIG bonuses, and now he's voting for this. Are you guys sure you want him as Palin's running mate in 2012? Because I'm thinking we might be able to land him as a speaker for RhinoCon. I think that's a little bit much, of course. But, I mean, Paul Ryan is one of those guys who's seen as extremely hardcore on fiscal issues, and yet his sort of willingness to play ball in this tax cut deal is not winning him a lot of fans among the very conservatives among the very conservative side of the blogosphere.
It's always a very difficult analysis which side's purist are the most unreasonable. I have a hard time making that judgment,
I can see principled arguments against the tax deal on either side, but my big concern is that I think Republicans think they're going to get some kind of miraculously better deal with more folks in Congress, and I think because of all this pressure you've seen put on the Obama administration, I don't really think we're going to get a better deal come January, and I'd much rather focus our political capital on the spending bill, for instance.
Well, the criticism, I think those on the left and right who are saying no deal, I think both don't really care if the taxes actually go up on everybody, because they both think that they would win politically by blaming the other side. Mm-hmm. What would almost surely happen if there was no deal would be Speaker Boehner would come in, they'd pass a pure Republican bill, which would be, you know, extend the Bush tax cuts for everybody and nothing else. So there'd be no Obama tax cut, there'd be no payroll tax suspension and reduction. There'd be no unemployment benefits extension. It would just be the Bush tax cuts extended, and perhaps no estate tax at all. And that would probably get filibuster in the Senate, or if they managed to get squeaked through there, get vetoed by Obama, and you'd have some kind of you'd have a straight up fight. And I think purists on both sides want to see that fight and think they'd be to the advantage. And clearly Obama and Boehner and McConnell both have a certain degree of uncertainty who would come out the better in that fight. It's another neither party wanted to have it.
Yeah. Well, there's also, you know, moving from the taxes to the spending, I think that's the one where you're going to see a lot more conservative opposition and folks really focusing their efforts. Like the Dollar Pundit posted said, that folks will agree to the tax deal, and then they're going to really strongly oppose the spending bill. Precisely, you know, one gives cover to the other in a sense.
Well, I want to shift to the spending bill in a second, but I do want to explore that conservative post you said criticizing John Thune, because Thune is someone who is seen as interested in running for president.
Mm-hmm.
And when he knocked off Tom Daschle, was really heralded by the conservative movement as an up and comer. And he has said a number of things in the past, I'd say 12 months, that don't quite toe the party line, although his voting record is as conservative as they come. Although I guess he voted for TARP, which some are trying to treat as a huge scarlet letter.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like at this point, Thune is almost going out of his way to say things that are going to be antagonistic to the conservative blogosphere or conservative talk radio. Does that mean maybe he's not going to run for president, or does that mean you think there is another path to winning the nomination by distinguishing himself in this way?
You know, I'm not sure. I think in this case he knows. I think in this case his remarks are merely a way to sort of push back against. I imagine if he runs for president, he will be looking at a similar group. He'll be trying to pull together a coalition from sort of centrist economic conservatives, and then he himself is a social conservative. So he's going to try to split that line between the social conservatives who don't necessarily trust, that somebody like Mitt Romney's maybe struggled with, and additionally try to bring some sort of fiscal policy, you know, experience, chops to the table for someone who might be a social conservative, but maybe they're not so comfortable with a Mike Huckabee. I think he's trying to build that coalition, and I think in this specific case, his remarks had a pretty direct, they were pretty directly responding to the Romney op-ed. I mean, it was not even closely veiled. So I really think this is about presidential politics. I think it's a curious strategy, but I think if ultimately he is going to vote for this deal, it would make sense for him to sort of try to strongly argue for it, even if it is drawing the ire of some conservative bloggers at this point in time.
Well, as I've noted, I think, at other times, the person who won the Republican nomination the last time was not the favorite of the conservative blogosphere or conservative talk radio.
That's so true.
There is a path to win the Republican nomination that does not go through them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this is just a side tangent. I'll digress quickly. But everybody thought that McCain couldn't be elected because of his immigration bill, and he won the nomination on the Republican side. So all these folks now that have been chattering with regards to the mandate and, you know, oh, Romney can never win the nomination because of this, I would direct folks to all the statements about how McCain could never pull off the nomination because of the immigration bill. I really wouldn't count anybody out at this point.
No, I would add, I believe almost every Republican nominee in 2008 was compromised on immigration from a conservative perspective.
Well, I think folks tried to stay away from the issue, unless you were Tom Tancredo and that was your issue. Just because it was a wedge issue, and people didn't really want to push on a wedge issue within the party, especially one where it could really cost him in a general. But to be sure, people gave McCain a tough time in the debates over his immigration vote.
And he, I think, was probably the most vocal about his stance. I mean, McCain was, we're totally digressing, I apologize for
being
on blogging. But McCain was always fascinating because he went out of his way to take certain moderate positions in the Republican primary when it's hardest to do so. Mm-hmm. And then after winning the nomination doing that, then swung all the way to the right for the general election, which was
kind of a backwards strategy, but
totally befuddling to me. Anyway, you mentioned the spending bill. There is a need for Congress to pass some kind of spending bill to make sure the government's doors stay open. The current funding authority runs out on Saturday, and there's a bit of a game of chicken in terms of how do you structure that. Do you just simply keep all funding levels where they are right now? That's called a continuing resolution. And if you did it that way, how long a continuing resolution do you have? I think Republicans would prefer it to be very short, so they, when they come into Congress next year, they can then do a bill on their own terms. And there's a last attempt on the Democratic side to have what they call an omnibus bill, which has a bit more variation from where current funding levels are. It's slightly bigger in cost than what you would do if you froze the levels, but very marginally so. And in the version they've just introduced in the Senate, it does have some earmarks in it. Percentage-wise, an extremely small amount, although you could say it's got 6,000 earmarks if you want to make it sound like it's a lot. Both parties have plenty of earmarks in it. Even even after Republicans had announced they had voted to voluntarily ban earmarks on their side. And I take it there are some conservative bloggers who are none too happy with those Republicans who have done those earmarks.
I mean, the frustration is that this omnibus bill, you know, it allows it to be bulked up with all this stuff. Congressional Quarterly estimates that the omnibus comes in at a price tag that's about $18 billion more than if we just kept the funding stable with a continuing resolution. And
which is, like, nothing.
Well, it's the principle. Why are we spending $18 billion more than is necessary to keep the government going? I think that, you know, in these times, especially when folks are looking for ways to cut, why is a bill, specifically one that has Republicans putting stuff into it, going to go through that costs $18 billion more than it needs to?
You could make the argument that one penny more is too much, I suppose, but
yeah. So I think, and so you've got, you know, Tom Coburn, Jim DeMint, they are teaming up, and they're expected to make the clerk of the Senate read the bill. McCain's identified, as you mentioned, 6,488 earmarks, and from the perspective of, I can't believe the Democrats would suggest this, isn't this tone deaf? You have Philip Klein at American Spectator who says, whatever else you want to say about the omnibus spending bill, from a purely political perspective, it's a pretty amazing example of how out of touch Democrats are with the spirit of the times. A little over a month after they took a shellacking at the polls, they decided to introduce a $1.2 trillion spending bill with thousands of earmarks, including things like $8 million for the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the Senate. It's a rich target for Republicans to show themselves as opposed to government spending at a time when Democratic strategy was supposed to be about portraying them as fiscal frauds. So it's he's sort of saying, you guys just lost because you spent too much. This is now your time to sort of pretend like you care about fiscal responsibility, and yet you've passed this bill. But Republicans don't get off any easier among conservative bloggers. You have Glenn Reynolds at Instapundit saying anyone who votes for this should be treated as a pariah. And you had an interesting exchange between Bill Hemmer and it was either Cornyn or Thune. I think it was Cornyn who said, why, if you're so opposed to earmarks, you have earmarks in the bill. Why didn't you take them out? And both Cornyn and Thune have come out and said, you know, this bill was in the works. The sausage was being made for a long time. These, you know, are individually defensible earmarks, but we would absolutely be fine with taking them out. And it's a sort of interesting dance that they're doing, and the conservative blogosphere is not letting up on the pressure on these folks who have said they're against earmarks, and yet the proof is in the bill.
And Dave Weigel at Slate had an interesting piece on, you know, one, why it is that we know they have these earmarks, and why it is that Republicans have done it this way. We know this because a bill passed a few years ago to make the earmark process transparent. It used to be you didn't know who did the earmarks. Mm-hmm. I would argue it's certainly better to know who's doing what, then you can judge the earmark itself fairly, and so it's not done in a back doorway. So their names are on this thing because of a bill that got passed by Congress a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And what we're learning is, and Weigel argues this sort of originated by Ron Paul. Ron Paul would always hustle to get his own earmarks in a spending bill, and then thunder against the overall bill and vote against it. So he wins both ways. He's seen as sort of bring home the bacon while also being seen as a fiscal scold. And it appears that Cornyn and Thune and Wicker in Missouri and Mississippi and some others aren't going through, you know, they're not proposing amendments saying, please strip out my earmark, please. Mm-hmm. I would not like it there. They're trying to hang on that. Well, I'm going to vote against the whole thing. Well, you know, you are probably crossing your fingers that the thing actually gets passed. And you're getting a free ride on it.
Well, and that's something that Olipundit at Hot Air said was, aren't the earmark provisions in the omnibus bill actually a great opportunity for Boehner? If it passes, Bill Kristol surely right that one of the first orders of business in the House come January will be stripping them out, which will force Reid and Obama to explain why you shouldn't. And I can't wait to hear that argument. Because this also traps Obama in a bind, doesn't it? Because he sort of came out and said he doesn't want earmarks either. But if he gets handed this bill on his desk, I think Gibbs said, well, he'll sign it, but he won't like it.
Right. And
Democrats seem to be doing a lot of that these days. I'll vote for it, but I won't like it.
Well, I think it does put Obama in a bit of a tough spot. And Obama himself has said that it was a regret of his earlier on that he signed a bill with earmarks in the past. And while saying, I mean, I think the fairer analysis is that, yes, earmarks, you know, may not be the greatest thing on the planet, but in the bigger picture of things, they're not the biggest, you know, cancer on our government either. So why would you, you know, provoke a government shutdown over the whole subject if you don't have to, particularly in a tough economy? And so Obama had said, look, we did a number of things on an emergency basis that includes stuff that they didn't like, but we were in an emergency, and perhaps going forward we need to put more emphasis on changing the process. Mm-hmm. So clearly he's not doing that with this bill, which I think has even fewer earmarks than the last one, even smaller percentage of the bill. But he certainly can get hit because he has said he does not like earmarks and would like to see them stop. So it does. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a vulnerability, but arguably it might be a worse vulnerability if he vetoed legislation that's going to keep the doors open and provoke the government shutdown himself. Mm-hmm. That might be a tougher political road for him to hoe.
Yeah. Do you think that I mean, I'm having trouble seeing how this really gets. I mean, I suppose there are a handful of Republicans who've said that they'll vote for it. I think they said that. I think that they're looking for the votes to get it done, but because I assume once this gets to the House that this would be something that Democrats would not be hugely opposed to, and with their current majority, do you see that this would run into any trouble if it?
I would assume if it gets through the Senate, it would sail through the House.
Yes.
I would not think you'd have a major problem with that. I think the bigger issue is, I mean, and there's only 48 hours until this happens, unless they could pass another short-term thing. They could pass something that's even for a week if they wanted to, mm-hmm. just to slam dunk it and move the debate off. But, you know, Reid is trying to get through both this bill, the START treaty, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal primarily. I mean, they've already gotten through, you know, the African-American farmers settlement. They've gotten through the child nutrition bill. They got through a food safety bill, though it's got a procedural wrinkle in it, so it might have to go back to the Senate. So they're trying to have a very productive post-election session. And I would note that there was a conservative attempt before Election Day to try to frame the quote-unquote lame duck session as somehow an immoral, undemocratic place to pass legislation. And that argument has really fallen by the wayside. Democrats have not flinched at pushing through major legislation, or trying to, this month. Mm-hmm. So that is not in their way. The only thing in their way at this point is time. And some time has been chewed up because they had to go through a more rigmarole around the tax cut deal than they might have liked. And, you know, if DeMint is reading the entire omnibus bill on the floor, that's just losing time. So that's the main enemy right now. And folks on the left, and this might segue into some of our other discussions on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, the left is not going to let Dems off the hook if they lose because of time. They're going to get hit for incompetence if they do that, fairly or unfairly. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a lot of pressure on Reid to do something, and if they get hung up on this bill, that pushes back these other priorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the idea, I think that, I mean, Republicans are now, I imagine in the Senate that there will be plenty of pressure, that the folks who they might be able to peel off in the Senate are folks like a Voinovich or someone like, you know, but I think it's going to be very tough for anyone who wants to be reelected. I mean, the ire in the conservative blogosphere for this omnibus bill is pretty great. And when you have the opportunity to just do a continuing resolution, and as long as Republicans could say, why don't we just do this, I think that they're going to be able to have some strength on the argument that Democrats are the ones that are going to shut down the government because they only want this bill that's got all this junk in it, and we don't need this junk.
Well, that may be what happens. I don't know yet. You know, this has happened because the Senate Appropriations Chair, Senator Inouye, he is old school. You're not going to tell him what to do. And he structured the bill the way he structured the bill. And, you know, Reid has to keep his caucus together. I can't mind read everything that goes on internally within the Senate. They obviously thought it was necessary to at least give this a shot. And I don't know if that means that they know deep down they're going to have to relent and go continuing resolution for a smaller bill, or they know deep down that Collins and Stone and Brown are going to be with them on the omnibus, so they don't have to pull back. I don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably one way or the other, I mean, you know, Reid gets a lot of knocks. I've always been, you know, mainly a Reid defender as someone who understands the rhythms of the Senate and gets done what can get done, and it's often very creative about it. And sometimes I think his choices aren't obvious on the outside, but within the weirdness of the Senate, you know, can make a lot more sense. But if we can segue into the Don't Ask, Don't Tell issue, because now you have enough Republicans who have said, I will be for not just Don't Ask, Don't Tell in theory, I will be for a standalone Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal bill, so long as I get enough time for amendments and blah-de-blah-de-blah. that there's a threshold now that says you can do this. You cannot blame anybody. You have the votes. You're not going to have the votes in a month. You have them now. So if you blow this, the folks in the liberal blogosphere, particularly in the those that focus on gay rights, there will be no quarter for failure. You have Joe Sudbay at America Blog said very, very clearly, the pressure is on. The majority leader needs to get this to the bill to the Senate floor ASAP. Collins and Brown and Murkowski and Lugar and Snow need to do more than say they support repeal. They actually need to vote repeal. So he's putting his pressure on both sides. And the president needs to use his bully pulpit. And that's always a big frustration. The president doesn't elevate these things through speeches, although I often think the president finds it more conducive to passage by being low-key about certain things and making it less polarizing. But be that as may, it's not the way a lot of bloggers look at it. Anything that is seen as not 100% effort, and you don't get success, that's going to lead to a bigger rift if it doesn't happen. So there's a lot of pressure on Reid to get this done. And with these votes in hand, I would suspect he would get it done for that reason. But
well, I recall
the Senate's a weird place.
I recall there was some confusion. I believe this was last week, flipped on C-SPAN, because everybody said, right now Reid's pulling Don't Ask, Don't Tell up to the floor, and Susan Collins was giving remarks saying, I was with you. Hold on. What are you doing? We were talking about this. Stop. Pump the brakes. Let's do this in a couple days. Why? You are ruining this by doing this now. What's going on? And so the tweets I kept seeing were basically from anyone liberal that I knew, and it sounds like your remarks have supported this, is like, what is he doing? Don't screw this up. Please don't screw this up. And so now that I guess you've got all these folks out there, the pressure's really on. Because what's odd is on the conservative side, I have not seen a ton about this in the blogosphere. I mean, most of the firepower is right now being devoted toward the spending bill. And my theory on this is because the strongest advocate for maintaining Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the Senate, or one of the most vocal, is John McCain. And John McCain's, buddies, and I don't think that John McCain and Lindsey Graham, for instance, are really conservative darlings. And so the fact that this is sort of their pet issue, I don't know that it's generating as much interest in the blogosphere as these fiscal issues, which I think also goes along with the election results. I mean, this was an election that wasn't decided on social issues. It was very much so decided on economic issues. So I don't think that the right has been super vocal. The folks who are for it are for it. The folks who are against it are against it. But I think there's much more desire to criticize an Olympia Snow or something like that on a potential break to vote for the spending bill rather than Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
I mean, is any of this political? I mean, polling for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell is actually quite large. It's, mm-hmm. It's about two-thirds of the country at this point. I mean, you can very easily make the argument that as far as public opinion is concerned, this debate is over and the left won. Is there some pragmatism on the right here saying, that this is not a, I mean, obviously folks like the Family Research Council, the social conservatives are going to go to the bitter end on this, but it doesn't mm-hmm. seem like everyone else on the right is.
I mean, I certainly don't want to say that the right doesn't have an appetite for fighting on social issues, but I think that the center of gravity has just really shifted to these economic issues. That's where people are focusing their efforts. That's where people are focusing all their energy and their pushback. And so, for instance, in the House, you had 15 Republicans who voted in favor of repeal. I think that Republicans have seen that this is something, in the House, they knew it was going to go through. Why bother?
The military is behind this now. It's not seen as being in opposition to the military brass.
No, I saw on Powerline, although this was old. This is older than a week. They were discussing some criticism of the survey process that had gone on, where military folks who had to take the survey, they had a letter from a gentleman in the Marines who said, you had to enter all these ID codes and stuff, and so they told you it was secret, but it didn't really feel secret, and so I can imagine people felt very uncomfortable expressing concern about serving alongside open homosexuals, even if they did have those concerns, sort of casting doubt on whether or not people were honest in taking the survey.
Even if that's true, that could easily cut both ways.
That is true. So I think that, but that was really, I was very stunned in reading through all the blogs this week that I just didn't see a lot about this. Whereas, I mean, the things about the stimulus and, or not the stimulus, the earmarks, the omnibus spending bill, that was where all the energy was.
Other aspect of Don't Ask, Don't Tell blogging that I've seen on the left as of late is a beginning of some reassessment of Joe Lieberman, because Joe Lieberman has been the leading Democrat shepherding this across and negotiating with his Republican friends.
Mm-hmm.
David Kurtz at Talking Points Memo saying, I admit I thought Lieberman was bluffing when he said he could get the votes before last week's fail vote, and when he continued to say it this week, I started to wonder what he was smoking, but Lieberman, hard as it will be for many people to give it to him, deserves a hell of a lot of credit if repeal passes. You had Jamel Bowie at American Prospect saying, I'm no fan of Lieberman. Lieberman has been the greatest Democratic ally. See his behavior during the fight over health care reform, but he's been there when it counted. Lieberman voted for the stimulus, health care reform, financial reform, was vile to crafting climate change legislation. When Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal failed to pass the Senate last week, Lieberman promised the votes for a standalone bill, and lo and behold, it looks like we have the votes for a standalone bill. I'm no fan of Lieberman, but if repeal passes, I might have to move him from despised to tolerable. Andrew Sullivan goes even farther than that and has a post saying, Joe Lieberman's civil rights hero. And that prompted a post at Salon, I think it was Alex Paris, saying, it's okay to still hate Lieberman. He's still awful on a slew of fronts. Just because he does some good things doesn't mean you have to completely ignore all the bad things that he has done. So I don't know if it's true that everyone in the blogosphere is going to embrace Lieberman with open arms, but and none of the folks I did cite, I would say, are from the more hardcore defiant corners of the progressive blogosphere, but some folks are starting to balance their assessment of Lieberman, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys have Lieberman, and we have McCain leading the charge on our side, so it's kind of
but
odd.
McCain screwed you on start!
Oh, well, I guess moving on to start, in fun segue. It's looking more and more like the new last time we spoke, I think I had mentioned that the big conservative argument against the treaty was the missile defense, the language in the preamble, which that remains the big sticking point, but now has solidified into a more concrete sort of request where people are really pushing for the negotiation records, saying, you know, that we need to know what was said in these discussions when the Russians stuck this language in. What are their expectations? Because if their expectations are so different from what it is we think we're voting for, that's going to create a problem. We need to hash that out now and fix it before we vote to ratify.
I actually went up and looked at the language. You mentioned this last time we talked. I wasn't aware of the preamble language. And let's stress, it's the preamble. We're not talking about the bulk of the treaty. But it's pretty vague language. So it's a question of interpretation whether it literally means that you can't have missile defense. So that's not the way America is treating it. And Lugar had a retort in a press statement saying, you know, if Russia wanted to interpret it that way and withdraw from the treaty, you strike the preamble language. There's still a clause at the end of the treaty where both sides can withdraw for basically, you know, whatever reason they choose. That's kind of a duh clause, because obviously anyone can nullify a treaty whatever they feel like. It seems like hanging a lot on the preamble issue doesn't seem like a constructive criticism. I just want to improve this treaty. It seems like an excuse to try to kill the treaty.
Well, I think a lot of conservatives have, I don't want to say caught themselves in a bind, but this request now where we need more time to look at a treaty. And researchers at Heritage found that, you know, looking back decades and decades and decades, it's without precedent that you would ratify a major treaty during a sort of lame duck, right at the end, let's go, go, go sort of session. And so the fact that this hasn't been more visible earlier, again, could be something where you could blame that on Reid, that this is a Republican talking point that shouldn't be there had this not been pushed. But you have John Tabin at the American Spectator, who says, you know, what's binding in a treaty, or for that matter, any agreement or statute, is the formal language the parties adopt, not the sausage making it took to get there. Nevertheless, where there is ambiguity, as there obviously is in New START, the underlying record clues us in on what the parties understood those ambiguous terms to mean, mutual understanding being the essence of a contract. And in keeping with standard operating procedure, I believe these negotiating records, I don't understand why there's such difficulty in providing these to concerned Republicans and therefore shutting down the
party. Have negotiating records ever been released? Ever?
I believe that these things are not as closed behind closed doors as they are right now. And again, the Obama White House has been called on this, not just regarding this treaty, but, you know, regarding the press, that they have not been particularly transparent, despite this whole, you know, hope and change and transparency, that the press has also run into issues where the Obama administration has been rather opaque. So, again, if this is an easy request, I'm going back to what I was saying 2 weeks ago. If it's easy little requests that don't mean anything, just grant them and then take these talking points away from Republicans.
It wouldn't be a stretch to think that perhaps they discuss some sensitive matters like what this means as far as their posture to Iran or something that maybe they would not want to be made public.
Well, I mean, yes, that's possibly true if you're having classified discussions. But by tweaking the bill, I mean, the John Tabin quote is tweaking New START, deleting language in the preamble that seeks to limit missile defense. It's a good idea. It would be a mistake for Reid to try to jam the treaty through without doing so. Scott Johnson at Powerline says, consideration of the treaty in the lame duck session of Congress raises a procedural issue as well. And this goes to a point you made earlier about to what extent is it immoral to pass bills in a lame duck. You haven't heard as much of that argument, but you are here on START, where he says, isn't it fundamentally illegitimate to ram a treaty through in the lame end of a lame duck session? There's something deeply disturbing about Democrat shenanigans on this point as well, that for something that is this big, where you could pull together it's a special thing. You need the supermajority of votes. That the lame duck is a particularly ill-suited time to rapidly push something like this through. And you also have conservatives like Jennifer Rubin at The Washington Post, who the frustration over New START might not necessarily be... I mean, the frustration is rooted in a greater concern that the whole U.S.-Russian relations reset has not been reset in America's favor at all, and in fact has led to us giving up too much to Russians, too much deference to Russians, even when, for instance, they're still occupying Georgia and we haven't offered assistance to Georgia in any sort of substantive way. And so I think it's woven into a broader sense that we have already been giving up too much to Russia. Why do we continue to do so? We need to wait until the new Congress comes in and make sure that we're not getting the raw end of the deal.
But it seems this notion that the lame duck session is an inappropriate place to discuss a treaty. I mean, doesn't say that argument has literally been lost. They had the vote to start the debate on the Senate floor, and 9 Republicans joined the Democrats to start the debate, to giving them 66 total votes. And if one absent Democrat was there, it would have been 67, which is the number of votes you need to actually pass the treaty, because it's a 2/3 vote. Now, it doesn't mean that they literally have all the votes they had to pass, but they have enough votes saying it is appropriate to discuss this now. So it would seem that trying to defeat this on that sort of broad procedural argument is not working. And further, I wonder if the Kyle DeMint argument that it is inappropriate to vote on a treaty in proximity to Christmas was a dramatic overshoot of that argument, to the point where now it's subject to much mockery. Crooks and Liars is Nicole Bell. Her headline was, Kyle and DeMint thinks baby Jesus doesn't want them to vote on START during Christmas. I think it actually was Reid's spokesperson, forgive me if I'm misquoting, but I believe on Twitter retorted to DeMint saying that by listing all the START hearings over the past 8 months that DeMint did not attend, to argue that there was this is not being jammed in anyone's throat. This has been on the table for several months and plenty of time to read the thing.
What continues to perplex me, and I would be interested in hearing what the liberal blogosphere has to say about why keep the language in, though? I mean, I keep going back to the same point, I know, but you have Con Carroll at the Foundry for Heritage saying, this, you know, start on the votes are potentially there. Some of the GOPS votes would rather wait till the new Congress. The Senate parliamentarian has ruled that the preamble is amendable. So if the Senate can change it,
well, the Senate's not the Duma, you know.
Well, no, I know, but so why not have the Senate change what it wants to change? And if Russia really wants this, if this language is so critical, and if it is so binding, I mean, that's why they're asking for the why did Russia put this in the first place? If we take it out, is it going to make them reject the treaty? That's where the vast majority of that frustration is coming from. And
I mean,
so,
once you start amending treaties in various legislatures, you know, I mean, and I think Russia's already started to threaten this. Hey, you're going to start amending what we're going to start amending. Mm-hmm. And guess what? You have no treaty. I read the language. I found the language completely innocuous, very vague and nebulous.
So you and I disagree then on that one.
I saw nothing in that language to say you can't have a missile defense whatsoever. And it seems like a ticky tack argument to try to unravel a thing, and not a serious argument that is with an interest of getting a good treaty done at the end of the day.
Okay, well we'll just disagree on whether or not that preamble language is serious enough to warrant pushing this until the next Congress.
Well, one last topic before we wrap up is Michael Steele is running for re-election for RNC chair. I think this whole subject has not gotten a lot of attention in the liberal blogosphere beyond just sort of general mockery that Michael Steele is running for re-election for RNC chair. But it does seem like it's a real race, and a race that Steele could win from what I gather on conservative blogs.
Yes. So the conventional wisdom heading up to Steele's conference call that some have noted was like the LeBron James, the decision special on ESPN, sort of jokingly, the expectation was that Steele would not run because, you know, the conventional wisdom is that his time as chairman, the RNC is not in great financial shape, that there has been a number of controversies that have come out of this, that major donors are unhappy. That's why you saw such good financial health in things like American Crossroads, the outside group, where you had a lot of donors turning to the RGA. And so the conventional wisdom outside of the 168 members of the Republican Committee was, you know, that Michael Steele he wouldn't run. But what everybody's forgetting is that the race for RNC chair is unlike anything else that you or I will ever see an election for. It is extremely it's personal. It's about friendships. It's about people who have been working side by side in the Republican Party for decades. It's who's friends with who. It's who uses what consultants. There are so many layers to this. And you've also now got the layer of who is conservative enough to be RNC chair, which I don't necessarily know. I mean, I'm no historian on how previous RNC chairs have been chosen, but the policy positions or the extent to which one is considered conservative may not have factored in as much in the past as can you run this organization, can you raise the money? Whereas now you have some folks who are being challenged on their conservative credentials or supported because of their conservative credentials. So one of the big contenders out there is Reince Priebus, and he used to be Michael Steele's lead counsel. And so it was sort of a big deal that he was breaking from Steele and running against him. And he's now come under fire. Some in the conservative blogosphere are unhappy because it's particularly Jim Hoft at Gateway Pundit who has pointed out that Reince Priebus, he worked for a law firm that had advertised that it would support its clients in navigating the regulations around the stimulus and would help them to put themselves in the best position to take advantage of the stimulus. So on one hand, you have conservative bloggers who say, look, this guy, he's just a lawyer who sort of implicitly supported the stimulus because he was helping his clients take advantage of it. On the other hand, at Red State, a very conservative blog, you have a blogger who goes by the name Lexington Concord who said, you know, a lawyer, just because you support your client doesn't mean you agree with your client or you agree with what your client did. That's the whole that's the ethics of being an attorney, is that you are there to help your clients navigate regulation and are there to look for the best outcome for them. It's not about you personally agreeing with what your client is doing or what they did. So that's sort of being rejected as a false argument. But it is interesting to see that this potentially strong candidate is coming under fire for an attack on his conservative credentials. You also have Jim Hoft at Gateway Pundit, who says that Maria Sino, who is a candidate who right now in various whip counts that are put together of public, who is publicly announced that they're voting for one candidate or another, she comes up toward the bottom. But she has the support of Dick Cheney and Ed Gillespie and some of these establishment figures. But you have Jim Hoft, a Gateway Pundit, saying she is an Obamacare lobbyist. So a lot of these folks, what they have done professionally prior to this election, and to the extent that it is viewed as unfriendly to the conservative movement or conservative goals, is being held against them. You've got Tim Mack at From Forum, who says he wouldn't bet on Steele to win, but don't count out his influence in the student council elections that are the RNC race. And basically says that, right after the announcement, the conventional wisdom was, this is crazy, he's not going to win. But that within a very short period of time, he received an email from half a dozen to a dozen RNC committee members saying, we support Michael Steele. And I've read some of these quotes where the people are saying, running an organization is difficult, and we think that, we had these historic wins, and so, things aren't going to be perfect, and the RNC is going through some tough times, but lots of organizations are, and we stick by Michael Steele. The sorts of things that folks who are outside of the Republican National Committee might go, this is, whoa, the RNC is dealing with a little bit more than just some tiny financial trouble. I mean, this is an organization in crisis that really needs some strong leadership to carry it forward, so...
Do we have a sense of what is the basis of what support for Steele there is? I mean, when Howard Dean was DNC chair and he took a lot of pot shots from some Washington Democrats, like Rahm Emanuel, for example, that didn't like Dean, they didn't like Dean's strategy, they didn't like the 50-state plan, they thought he was wasting money in states and districts that where Democrats didn't have a shot. But because the actual DNC members were largely not in Washington, they were in those 50 states, they were very thankful that Dean was giving cash and staff to give them a chance and give them and make them viable, and they were the folks that had the vote. So that was the reason why Dean had more support than you might have picked up from reading the Washington political press. Do we know what is in those Steele relationships that is making him a viable contender for re-election?
I don't know specifically. That is the great mystery of this race, is, what the glue that is holding that coalition together, is it strong enough to sustain the onslaught from a variety of candidates, all of whom are gunning for that same seat? And so, now while these candidacies are all just beginning, you may see if more compelling arguments are being made or as other candidates begin to pick up steam, pieces of that Steele coalition peeling away. You also have, there are other candidates that I hadn't yet mentioned. There's Saul Anuzis, who he ran last time. And he's viewed as someone who could be a strong contender because last time around he ran a lot of the conservative blogosphere more of the sort of Republican tech consulting crowd really loved Saul Anuzis because he was someone who was tweeting and Facebooking and it wasn't, nobody else was doing these things. And so he was seen as someone who could take the party forward. He was unsuccessful in his bid last time, but he's back in it again. And
Is there one candidate that the blogosphere is rallying around? Is it Saul or are they split?
It's all very fragmented. The one sort of theme that I saw is that a lot of conservative bloggers were on ideological, I don't want to say purely on ideological grounds, but we're saying that Anne Wagner, she had formerly been co-chair. She's from Missouri, and that she is the type of conservative woman that we need running the RNC. And she's now, I think, seen as someone who has a lot of pull. She's got a number of public endorsements. So I would say for folks who are very interested in not necessarily conservative bloggers, but more conservatives who work in the tech world, are very bullish on Saul, but that Anne Wagner is pulling in some support as well. You also have Gentry Collins, somebody else who his claim to fame is that he's sort of an operative type. So he was the political director and wrote this scathing memo that when you read it was actually very professional in tone, but that was very harsh in terms of how badly the RNC has operated over the last few years or last 2 years. And so, you know, sort of that was his, he resigned, he put out this memo and started his own candidacy. So it's kind of controversial. Is a move like that, is that going to alienate people? Or did it just demonstrate his competence as the sort of person that we want running the show as we go into a presidential year? So remains to be seen.
All right. Well, perhaps we should leave it on that note. If I don't talk to you again before the holidays, have a very happy holiday season.
You too.
So I'm actually not sure what our schedule is for the rest of December, but if we don't see you in the next couple of weeks, we will certainly see you in January, and that will do it for This Week in Blog. Take care.
Take care.